Blog Talk Radio.
LifeQuest Christian Network.
Welcome to Reflecting His Gifts. I'm Sissy Ellison, your host, and I believe that all our gifts and talents are given to us by God, our Creator. James 1:17 tells us that every good and perfect gift comes down to us from God, our Father, who created all the lights in the heavens. I believe that two of the greatest gifts God ever gave humans was the ability to cry and to laugh. Solomon, the great king of Israel, wrote in Ecclesiastes, "There's a time to weep and a time to laugh." And in Proverbs, he wrote, "A merry heart doeth good like medicine, but a broken spirit dryeth the bones." God uses both tears and laughter as powerful healing agents. Laughter has gotten me through many of my own toughest moments. I'm grateful that my childhood was spent in much laughter, since my mom was the first natural comedian I ever knew. She could make a dull day exciting and joyful. She could turn tears into laughter with her funny songs, her silly dances, and her own contagious laughter. I learned early on what a really good belly laugh was, and I've never been satisfied with half-hearted, superficial facsimile since. I just love a great, big, exhausting, tear-producing, tummy-aching belly laugh. It makes me feel better. Those kinds of laughs have been scientifically proven to produce all kinds of emotional and physical health benefits. We all need to laugh more and to find the humor in as many situations as possible. Laughter and humor are truly gifts from our Creator, and we're to use them in generous proportions every day to promote joy and positive outlooks in every area of our lives. I believe we serve a God who smiles and laughs frequently, and that's why He gave that gift to us. My guest this evening is author and jollytologist, Alan Klein. Alan promotes the benefits and healing power of humor as a speaker and a writer. His book, The Healing Power of Humor, documents his own experience with the healing power of humor as he writes about the many ways that laughter can enhance and help to heal our minds and lift our burdens. Alan's going to share with us his thoughts about laughter, how it affected his own life as he dealt with grief, and how we can be healed and helped as we learn to find humor in life. It's my pleasure to welcome Alan Klein to our program tonight. Hi, Alan.
Hi. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
It's so wonderful to have you on. Laughter is one of my favorite subjects and one of my favorite things to do. Alan, all of our life stories begin in our childhood, of course, and I know our listeners would love to hear about yours. Would you tell us about the young Alan Klein, where you grew up, and about your family and your hobbies, and did you like to laugh as a child?
Well, I grew up in the Bronx, New York. I was actually born in Manhattan, but raised in the Bronx. And looking back and what I hear my family tell me, I was a very serious child.
Wow.
So the fact that for over 20 years now I've been teaching about therapeutic humor, laughter, and happiness is a bit surprising to me. But I also believe that sometimes what we don't get in our childhood, we get in later on in life. So
yeah.
maybe that was my case. And I was, I guess I'd rather, looking back, I'd rather play, you know, do play with myself and do things myself than get engaged with other kids. So
yeah.
we lived in a fifth floor walk-up.
Wow.
And one of my favorite things was a big metal, gosh, I wish I had this truck today, a metal moving truck.
Yes.
That I was able to sit on, and I would go up and down the hallway for hours.
Oh, wow.
And I remember loading the truck up at one end and making believe I was delivering whatever was in the truck at the other end and unloading it. And
wow.
The, you know, back and forth all day long.
What fun. That sounds like fun. I bet you got plenty of exercise, too, didn't you? Fifth floor up. Did you have elevators or did you have
No stairs? Elevators. It was a walk-up. And, Sissy, you know, the amazing thing, I'd say about 10 years ago, I had a treadmill test, you know, where they're testing my heart. And the doctor, when it was over, he said, "Your heart is really strong. Have you ever been an athlete?" And I said, "No, I'm not particularly fond of sports." I said, "But what I did do is over 20 years, I walked up and down 5 flights a day, probably several times a day. You know,
that
probably as a kid, going to school, coming home, going out for lunch, going back to school, coming back, change my clothes, go down and play, go up. My mom sending me down for the mail or get a container of milk, going up again. Summertime, going down in the evening to play again. Great exercise before they had walking machines."
That was a very wonderful exercise, though, and I'm sure that's why you're in good health like you are. And I was just commenting, you sound so young. And you told me your age. I'm not going to tell it, but you sure
don't
sound
your age. Oh, good. All right. Let people guess.
Oh, Alan, I believe that the things we love to do as children can often reveal our God-given purpose later on. You shared with me that your parents took you to your first Broadway show when you were 7 years old. Do you remember what the play was, and how did that experience influence your career choice and your life's work?
I don't remember exactly what the play was, but the first two shows I was taken to were were the hit of the day. Carousel was one, and Oklahoma was the other.
Wonderful.
And I don't remember which order I saw them in, but I do remember I sat so well through the first show that my parents took me to see the second show. And we came in late, and I refused to leave at the end. I thought that, like a movie, I could just sit there and see the beginning again because I loved it so much. And they had to drag me out of the theater. But from that day on, I said I wanted to make those pretty stage pictures that I had seen.
Wow.
And I didn't know the name, but I later learned it was called being a scenic designer.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know that's what it was called either until I read about you. Well, how did you pursue that passion as a career choice? Did you go to college to become a scenic designer?
Well, what happened is, I was in college, and even before that in high school, every Saturday, I would go down to see a Broadway show, and I would sit in the second balcony for $1.50.
Yeah,
now,
$1.50.
I mean, even second balcony is like $100
wow.
on Broadway.
Times have changed, haven't they?
I know. But I saw every Broadway show. I was at opening night of Hello, Dolly. I saw Rosalind Russell, the great actress. You know, Judy Holliday. I saw all these great people.
Oh,
and all these great classic shows.
Yes.
And
awesome.
So in high school, I did that, and then I got into college, and I started to design the college productions.
Yes.
And I remember the last year of my college, I basically did not go to any classes. In fact, they did a bit of an article about me in the college newspaper about who was this man who was walking around college hallways with paint-stained jeans all the time.
Yeah.
And that's because I was painting and building scenery all the time.
Oh, my goodness. But you didn't go to class?
Well, by the last year, I didn't have many classes to go to. It was some art classes, but I had finished most of the basics. So, and I got credit for doing some of those shows, and I was really fortunate, Sissy. I think, you know, sometimes there's a higher power that leads you in certain directions.
Yes.
And the one of the top professors in the theater there did stage lighting for the Metropolitan Opera and had gone to Yale Drama School, and so he got me into Yale Drama School in the scenic design department.
Wow.
But I should tell you the rest of the story.
Go on and tell me.
So it's a 3-year master's, and I'm in the first year. And because of the way they set up the program, they admitted 12 people the first year, but the second year they only allowed 8 because they only had 8 productions to design. And then the third year they cut that down to 4. So I was kicked out of Yale the first year.
Oh, no.
Basically, you know, I read that as saying, you know, I didn't have that much talent because the other kids were still in school.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back to New York City. I got in the Scenic Design Union after as an apprentice.
Mm-hmm.
And then after failing one test, it's a very difficult test to get in the union because
mm-hmm.
you have to know lighting, costume, and design. And I failed the first time, got in the second time, and immediately was hired by CBS Television. And
wow.
My fellow classmates at Yale was still in school designing school productions, and I was doing national TV.
Well, you know, I agree with you. God was in charge of that, and that's pretty wonderful. What did you do at CBS as a scenic designer, and what shows did you work on?
Well, I worked on Jackie Gleason show. I worked on Merv Griffin show.
Wow.
But the show that I did for 10 years and I think has certainly influenced me for the rest of my life was Captain Kangaroo.
Oh, my goodness.
And
I love him.
Yeah. You're not that old. How could you remember Captain Kangaroo?
Oh, don't bring up age. I'm not telling you, so don't bring up mine. No, I'm a diehard fan of all three of those shows you mentioned. I grew up watching Captain Kangaroo. I can hear that music in my head right now. Every single moment of my childhood, morning, I mean, and I listened to Jackie Gleason's music and the Honeymooners. I watched many
right.
of the Merv Griffin programs. I have to ask you what it was like working around those three incredible celebrities. They're three of my favorites. Did you come into close contact with them as you worked, and could you tell us a story or two about those experiences?
Sure. Well, Captain Kangaroo, I'd work with the director and the script on all those shows, but Captain Kangaroo, give you one example, if Bunny Rabbit was tricking Mr. Green Jeans into giving him some carrots, and he designed this machine that would trick Mr. Green Jeans into doing that, I was the one that actually designed that machine.
Oh, my goodness.
So I had to think like a child. You know, how would a child do that? Well, a child would probably take a cardboard box, go in the kitchen, maybe get a strainer or a cover from a jar and glue it, you know, and go around the house and, you know, whatever, and tie some fabric to it. I had to think like a child.
Yes.
And I think that really influenced me in my later life, looking at the world through childlike eyes.
Oh, that's so important. That's so important. Well, you saw Grandfather Clock, let's see, Bunny Rabbit, Mr. Blue.
Right, Dancing Bear, remember Dancing Bear?
Oh, Tom Terrific, all those wonderful things.
Yeah.
You know, kids were very fortunate back then because there were some really, really great children's shows on. I'm so glad you got to work on that. That was probably, like you said, one of the best experiences you had.
Oh, fabulous.
What about Jackie Gleason?
Well, Jackie Gleason was very talented, very funny, but it was not the easiest job in the world because, say, Jackie Gleason did a skit, say it was set in a supermarket.
Mm-hmm.
So I would design this whole supermarket. It's all built. It's all on stage. Jackie Gleason would come in to rehearse it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he'd go, you know, this isn't as funny as I thought it would be. Let's kill this. Let's get rid of this. I'll go back to the dressing room. I'll write another skit, and we'll go with that one. And so I'd get it. I have to rush back to the shop and redesign everything and have it ready in time. And it was pretty stressful.
I bet. I don't like those last-minute changes. You know, they throw me off.
Yeah, well... It's why they paid me so well.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, what were some of the sets and scenic designs that you created for those shows? Can you remember besides the grocery store? And how did that work influence your future career as a writer?
Well, the great thing about working on the Jackie Gleason show is money was unlimited.
Wow.
So you asked if I remember one. I mean, there was some fabulous people on every show. George Burns and Martha Ray.
Oh,
Tiny Tim. So for Tiny Tim,
man,
he sang Tiptoe Through the Tulips. So we got like 1,000 tulips flown in from Holland.
Goodness.
To put on the stage so he could walk through the tulips. I mean,
it
was that kind of unlimited expense. So that was kind of fun.
What a wonderful job. Well, how did that influence your future career as a writer?
I don't know, because
probably
it was so different.
Probably it sparked your imagination, wouldn't you think?
My imagination, well, any of the set design, I had to read the script and then use my imagination what it would look like. So, yeah, that definitely helps me today as a writer when I'm coming up with ideas for the book or stories in the book. It definitely, I never connected that, so thank you, Sissy. But, yes, it did spur my imagination.
Yeah. I understand that your wife hailed from San Francisco, which is where you're from now. How did you two meet? If you're in the Bronx, or did your work with TV and everything carry you out west?
No, it was all in Manhattan. I was living there working at CBS. Mm-hmm. My wife was from San Francisco visiting a friend who the friend was a costume designer. And I was doing the sets for an off Broadway show, and she was doing the costumes for that show.
Mm-hmm.
And one day she said to me, "Oh, a very good friend of mine is coming out from the coast. She's a gourmet cook, and she's going to make dinner for us.
Mm-hmm.
And could you come on?" She told me the night, at 7:00, and we'll have dinner. And I said, "Oh, that'll be great. I'd love to meet your friend." And I'm about to leave the house that night, and the friend calls me. I hadn't met her yet, but she says, my friend, the woman who was designing the costumes with me, went out to have a drink after work, and I had given her the shopping list of what to bring home, and she had one drink too many. She was with some buddies. And
right.
She didn't bring home half of what I need to cook dinner, and I don't have enough ingredients.
Yeah.
Could you stop at the Chinese restaurant and bring us dinner? And I said, I'll bring dinner for 3 people, not a problem. And she said, "No, we invited 12 people. Can you bring dinner for 12 people?
Oh, my goodness.
And that was my first encounter with my future wife.
That was kind of asking a lot, wasn't it?
It was a lot, but I thought anyone that had that much nerve, I really liked immediately.
Absolutely.
So we hit it off really well, and we had several trips back and forth across country, and eventually we got married.
Wow. Well, I understand that eventually you moved to San Francisco, one of the most beautiful cities in our nation. I've never been there, but it's on my bucket list. Was that a big change for you, and did you love living there? And
I had come here, as I said, courting my wife, and then she moved back east, and we were there for a couple of years, and we kept saying we want a Victorian house in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And I totally believe in mind maps and doing, drawings of what you want, treasure maps, and putting what you want in front of you so you see it all the time. And I would do that with Victorian houses. And then the landlord was trying to get us out of our rent-controlled apartment in New York City. And he got everyone out but two tenants, myself and someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a fire in the middle of the night.
Oh, no.
And I don't know, don't blame him, but the next day he came to my apartment. He offered all this money to us to move. And I said to my wife, Ellen, we're going to take the money and we're moving to San Francisco.
Yes.
And we did that, and a couple of years later, we did get the Victorian house that
wow.
we wanted. And then something happened that totally changed my life.
Yes, I want you to share that. You shared that your wife was diagnosed with a rare liver disease, and I'm so sorry, shortly after your move to San Francisco. How did this affect your lives, Alan, and what were some of your feelings and what were some of the changes you went through as you dealt with this illness?
Well, it was certainly a shock to us. She had gone to the doctor just for a checkup and said, I need to put you in the hospital and do some tests, and the results came back.
Mm-hmm.
And they found out she had primary liver disease, primary biliary cirrhosis.
Wow.
And there was no cure. There was no liver transplants at the time. And
yes.
the prognosis, and usually women over 65 get that, and Ellen was 31 at the time.
Oh, my.
And the prognosis was about 3 years, and she did last about 3 years. And
oh, my goodness.
It's a very, very difficult time, and we had a 10-year-old daughter at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I things that ran through my head is, I guess, run through a lot of people's heads at this kind of time is like, why me? Why did this happen to me? You
yeah.
know, I didn't sign up for this. But what happened was I saw Ellen, you know, there were lots of tears.
Mm-hmm.
But Ellen had a great sense of humor
mm-hmm.
and often used the humor to kind of rise above the situation.
Yes.
To help us get through some of it.
Yes.
And give you one example. She was in the hospital with a copy of Play Girl magazine with a male nude centerfold.
Oh.
And she said, Alan, I really like this hunky man this month. Can you put it on the wall by the bed over there? And I said, Ellen, this is a hospital. It's a little risque for that nude man on the wall. And she said, no. Well, maybe you want to get a leaf over there and cover up that part. And I did that, and things are fine for the first day, fine for the second day. But the third day, the leaves start shriveling up. And we would, just as you're laughing now, Susie, we would look at the photo, and we would start to laugh. And, you know, I realized looking back, it wasn't a lot of laughter. It was 5 or 10 seconds. But the
yes.
situation was so dire and so serious that just that little bit of laughter
yes.
helped revive us, gave us a little reprieve. And
right.
so when Ellen passed away, I went back to school. I had a business that I gave up here in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to look into therapeutic humor. And Norman Cousins, who was talking about healing himself with humor.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just thought, you know, read everything, researched everything I could, went back to school to get a master's degree in therapeutic humor, and started to write a book about it, which became my first book, The Healing Power of Humor, because I saw the power of humor to help me rise above anything, and I wanted to share that, had the passion to share that with other people.
Right, right. Well, I'm a firm believer in the power of laughter. I mean, it is a healing experience. I mean, I feel so much better when I can laugh about something. And when you were just describing that experience in the hospital, it made me laugh even then. And I think there is scientific evidence that there are chemicals that are released in our brains, our nervous systems, that really benefit our bodies and make us feel better. What do you know about the scientific evidence of the benefits of laughter?
Every system, Sissy, in our body gets a workout. I'll give you one example.
Mm-hmm.
Let's have a big laugh. What happens? You've got to take a big breath of fresh air in.
Yes,
so you're oxygenating your blood. You're getting more oxygenated blood to your brain, so you're thinking better.
Yes.
You're getting fresh air in your lungs. Stale air is going out of your lungs.
Yes.
You probably are more relaxed. It's harder to get out of your chair. you know, some people say fall down laughter,
right,
or they relax the muscles so much they pee in their pants when they're laughing.
Uh-oh.
But the latest research is Dr. Lee Burke from Loma Linda University in California.
Mm-hmm.
And he has proven that when you have a good hearty laugh, cortisol, the chemical cortisol, is less prevalent in your blood system because it's an immune suppressor. And
yes,
so there are
yes.
more important immune boosters when you're laughing in the blood system.
Mm-hmm.
So he's actually proved that it's physically good for us to have a hearty laugh.
Well, I feel it. I mean, I can feel so much better after I laugh, and I do that quite a lot. I had an experience at work, and I'll share this. A dear, dear friend of mine at work lost her husband a couple of years ago, and she was so depressed. And I'm quite a funny person myself. I just, you know, that's just my personality. And I began to stop by and talk to her. Well, we found ourselves laughing about the silliest things, and it got to where she just couldn't wait for me to pass by her desk because we would just burst out laughing. It was just like this phenomena that was happening every time that I came by her desk, and she said, "This is making me feel so much better. I've been so depressed." And I said, "This must just be something God is having me to do and having us both to, because I can't explain it." And to this day, she says, "I can't wait for you to pass by my desk 2 years later, because you're always going to say something funny and it makes me feel better."
Right. No,
it's
true. I mean, I get people in my workshops who have come up and told me, you know, "I lost my son 2 years ago," or, you know, "my husband." And sometimes they'll say, "I haven't laughed this hard in years, and this feels so good." Or, "This is the first time I've laughed in years, and I really needed this." I mean,
right,
I think instinctively we know we need this, but sometimes things get so stressful, or the things in our life seem so overbearing that it's hard to get that laughter.
Right, right. Well, I believe God gave us tear ducts, and those are for releasing tears, and that's very important to do that. But just as important is the ability He gave us to laugh, and we're supposed to use that very often.
Can I share with you about tears and laughter?
Yes.
There were two scientists, I think one is still alive, one isn't, and one person I studied with on laughter is Dr. William Fry, F-R-Y, Jr., and he taught at Stanford, and he did a lot of research on the therapeutic value of laughter. Mm-hmm. There's another Dr. Fry, F-R-E-Y, William Fry, who studied tears.
Wow.
What the FREY found out, and it's very connected to laughter, is that when you're cutting an onion and you cry, there's no toxins in those tears. But when when you cry from emotion, or when you cry, tears come because you're laughing so hard.
Yes.
There are toxins in both those cases in your tears. So you are getting those toxins out of your body, whether you're crying from emotion or whether you're laughing heartily.
You have essence of toxicity in your tears when you're laughing like that. Isn't that amazing?
Right.
I never knew that. That's something new I've learned.
Good.
Well, Alan, we're going to pause for a few moments, if you don't mind, to hear a word from our sponsor about the exciting Woodson series from gifted author Alexandra Clare. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
The Woods End Series by Alexander Clare. When Andrea is framed for murder, she discovers that divorce cannot sever the ties from a dangerous cult. Follow Boston Police Detective Jared Scheel as he sets out to solve a murder and kidnapping, only to confront a vast conspiracy competing to produce the last Antichrist of world history. Against the backdrop of drama and intrigue, the Woods End characters come to see that demons are on their last assignments. Bible prophecy unfolds in real time, and Jesus Christ is at the door. Two books, Woods End, and the thrilling sequel, The Year Between the Wood. Download from Kindle, Nook, Screwpulp.com, or purchase the softcover at Amazon. Also by Alexander Clare, a work of nonfiction, discerning spirits, visionary gifts in practice. Find it all at alexanderclare.com.
LifeQuest Christian Network. LifeQuest Christian Network.
Welcome back to Reflecting His Gifts. I'm having such a good time talking with author and speaker Alan Klein. Alan writes about the power of the healing power of humor and how humor can help even our very worst moments to be lightened and lessened. Alan, I believe that our worst and most painful trials in life can actually turn into our best lessons. I've experienced that and can actually equip us for our God-given purpose. Do you feel that your experience with your young wife's illness and death somehow ushered you into your true life's work and God-given purpose?
Oh, I certainly do, and I certainly believe that I've been guided by a higher power.
Yes.
To do this work, because amazingly enough, I almost failed speech in college.
Yeah.
I think I got a D or D minus. I hated getting up in front of a group and speaking. I hated raising my hand. And now I'm a professional speaker the biggest audience I have spoken to is 1,500 people in one room.
Wow.
And to go from fear of speaking and not even raising my hand in a small classroom to being in front of, 5 to 1,500 people, it's got to be some higher power that has led me to do this work.
It is. I believe that as well. I also believe that we can fight against pain and adversity and harden ourselves. In doing that, I feel that we will become bruised and even break, missing the wonderful opportunity to become resilient and positive and strengthened by our painful experiences. It's all a choice, isn't it? And you seem to have made a choice to make lemonade out of lemons, and this is very wonderful to me. You've actually made the world a happier and better place, and your own pain and your willingness to accept it and smile anyway has become a powerful tool to change the world. Was it hard sometimes, though, for you to continue to smile and laugh? And if so, how did you combat the tendency to despair? Because I'm sure you're a human being. At times you were in despair. And how did you fight that tendency to despair and become depressed?
Well, first of all, having a child, my daughter, she just always lifted me up when I was down. Mm-hmm. I remember after my wife died, I said to Sarah, my daughter, I said, we need an adventure. Somehow I knew that we needed to bond more. We needed to get away from the 3-year difficult years that my wife had the illness. And so we went on this trip to Alaska.
Yeah.
And we did whitewater rafting, and we did seaplane rides, and we saw puffins and bears. And we laughed a lot together, and we talked about her mother and my wife, and talked – rather than like ignoring it, if we would get in some situation where we didn't know what to do, we often said to each other, what would Ellen do? How would Ellen react to this situation? And often that would bring a smile or a laugh to our face. And so I think by keeping my wife alive with my daughter, it really helped to bond us. And to this day, we laugh a lot together.
Wonderful. That's wonderful. You sound like a very good father. That's a wonderful thing. Alan, you call yourself a jollytologist. I've never heard that word. Where in the world did you come up with that title and why?
Yeah, well, you haven't heard it because I made it up. Because I went back to school and learned about therapeutic humor. Mm-hmm. In Greek, the word for laughter is jellos, G-E-L-O-S, and ology means the study of. So basically, I was a jello-ologist. But people didn't know what that was. They thought I made that wiggly sweet dessert, you know, jello.
Yes. Yes.
So I changed it to jollytologist. And people kind of get a little inkling, and if they don't, they ask me, what is that? And so it's a chance for me to share what I do.
Well, I never knew that about the origin of, what did you say it was, J-E-L-O-S?
Jellos, G-E-L-O-S. It's a Greek word meaning laughter.
Yeah, that's something. Well, your first book, The Healing Power of Humor, is reaching its 40th printing, my goodness, is in 9 different languages. Why did you write that book?
Well, and I just had this path, you know, after the experience with my wife, mm-hmm. and realizing that even during the loss there is laughter, and how benefit, you know, there was tears too, but how people often just, you know, like they'll say, how can you laugh at a time like that?
Yeah.
Or that maybe you're being disrespectful for the deceased. Or, and what I saw was that it was not being disrespectful, remembering all the times we laughed together.
Yeah.
What I saw that it would actually help me get through that process, and I had
right.
to honor that. And yes,
yes,
tears were important, and I cried a lot.
Yes.
But it, you know, when I started to do research and I'd ask people, okay, you've lost someone, how would that person want you to remember them?
Mm-hmm.
And often they would say, oh, I'd want them to remember the happier times we had together, the joyous times we had together.
Absolutely.
And yet people often didn't do that. And so I realized how valuable the humor and laughter was, even during those difficult 3 years. And I just had I had this passion to share that with people.
Yes.
And so I needed to write that down, and I needed to speak about it and to get that message out in the world.
Yes.
That humor could help us get through any situation.
Absolutely. I think the best books, such as your type of book, come from people who've experienced what they're writing about, who are very passionate about it, who have had a powerful experience with whatever they're writing about. And I think those kinds of books just naturally reach out and touch the reader with the authenticity of it and the genuineness of it. And the fact that yours has reached its 40th printing, oh my goodness, I want to get that book now that I know about you and have talked to you. This book, Alan, has 14 techniques of how readers can increase their sense of humor. Could you give us a few of those?
Well, my favorite is to have a toy or a prop around, so you mm-hmm. just instantly remember to lighten up. And my favorite toy or prop is a red clown nose. And everyone in my workshops, I've probably bought 30,000 of those. Because everybody in my workshop, we do a whole process with it. They later take it with them. I get incredible stories of how people have used it to start a difficult meeting at work, how they use it to wake up their kids in the morning. One couple has them all over the house now, and whenever either of the couples is like upset or angry with the other person, might start yelling. They put a clown nose on and they just start laughing instead of yelling. So it's just having a reminder around that you can lighten up. So that's one technique that I like.
Yes.
So it could be the clown nose, it could be a jar of bubbles, which I'll often blow out bubbles out the window when I'm in traffic jams.
Mm-hmm.
It could have a picture that I'm looking at now, my daughter, with when she was a teenager wanted a cream pie thrown in her face, and she's just mm-hmm. totally joyous in that photo with the cream all over her face. I mean, just something to remind you to lighten up.
Right, right. Do you think there's certain people you can enjoy the gift of laughter with more than others? I can think of a couple of people in my life, actually my daughter and my grandson, and whenever we get together, it's kind of like, you know, you described with your daughter, it's just absolutely, it's like an explosion. I mean, I can laugh with them more than anybody else. Do you think there's certain people, it's like we all share a gene or something.
Right. No, I totally agree. It's like this chemical attraction that you both can laugh easily. Yeah, I have some friends that I, you know, don't laugh so easily with, and others that we're just hysterical all the time.
I enjoy that. I really enjoy friends like that. And I think that's what I'm describing I have with this lady at work. When I just
at work,
pass
exactly.
by, she just starts up. She just starts up and she says, Sissy, I can't stop whenever you walk by. And
I have a friend. We'll just say a word. You know? and we start laughing, you know, because it triggers back something that happened maybe even years and years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you have this bond with that person, and it, you know, and if I even try to describe it to you, it's going to sound stupid and not funny.
Yes, I know what you mean. But I had experiences like that too. My mom was one of the most, and to this day, she's 90, she'll be 92 in January. As soon as she calls me, as soon as we're on the phone, we start laughing. I mean, it's just, I really think there's a gene in us that's just called the laughter gene. I really
right.
do.
And you remind me of my mom, who I think is where I get my sense of humor. My father was very serious, and it was like, for him, the glass was always half empty. But my mom was totally opposite and a great attitude. And in my programs, I start by telling a story about my mom and her how she used laughter. And I'd like to share that with your listeners.
Yes, yes.
And she lived in a... not assisted living, but independent living facilities. And every time she went to the doctor, a van would come and take her to the doctor. And then when she was done, they'd take her home.
Mm-hmm.
So one night at 6 o'clock at night, the receptionist said she has to close the office, but the van didn't show up. But she'll take my mom downstairs to the pizza place down there, buy my mom a Coke, call the van, make sure they're coming. So they did that. And the van doesn't show up, so my mom goes up to the counter and asks the guy, does he deliver? And he says, yeah, lady, we're a pizza place. Of course we deliver. And she said, I'd like a pepperoni pizza, and I'd like to go with it.
Oh, what a good idea. That's so cute.
That's the kind of spirit of humor I grew up with.
Oh, I just love it. I love it. I love laughing better than anything. Alan, would you explain the difference between humor and laughter?
Okay, this is only my own simplified version because I belong to an organization called the International Society of Humor Studies, and they're mm-hmm. very academia kind of folk, and so they go on for days trying to... and they argue about the difference between laughter and humor, but I've just simplified it for myself and for some people in my workshops. So for me, humor is like seeing something that will help you to laugh or seeing something funny.
Yes.
So it's like an attitude. It's a way of looking at something.
Yes.
And then the laughter is like the expression of having seen that funny thing.
Yes.
So it's just that simple. That's the way I look at it.
I can see that. I see that very well in your description. Alan, in two of your other books, The Courage to Laugh and Learning to Laugh When You Feel Like Crying, you discuss the importance of humor in death, dying, and bereavement situations. Aren't those things too serious to joke about?
Well, you know, I used to be a hospice volunteer. Was one of the first volunteers of San Francisco Hospice. And yes, they may be too funny to joke about with the patient, or they may not be, depending how the patient was or the family who's in grief. But I'll tell you, when I went back to the office and we'd have a staff meeting and we would talk about dealing with some of the patients and some of the funny things or the inadvertently funny things that would happen, you know, we would start to laugh. And as the caregivers, it was so important that they could lighten up about their work because it was so stressful. And sometimes it was the only way they can get through dealing with somebody who's dying. You know, I mean, one hospice said they had 12 deaths in one day.
Wow.
That the staff had to deal with. And so if they can, you know, it's often called a gallows humor or black humor.
Mm-hmm.
And ambulance drivers use it, you know, policemen use it, first responders often use it. Because it's a way they cope with the difficult job they're doing.
Yes, yes. That's absolutely right. I know, Alan, you are a popular keynote speaker at lots of conferences. What do you tell your audiences?
Well, it's funny. Years ago when I joined the Speakers Association, I heard what you really need is one speech. Because you get all different, you know, you just keep getting different audiences. So, Sissy, basically I have one speech that sometimes is 20 minutes, sometimes it's 6 hours. But I used to do mostly all day. Now I do shorter things. But it's all based on the letters L-A-U-G-H. So the L, I'll just run by it really quickly. L is let go, that you can't laugh unless you start to let go of some of the things that stress you out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do all kinds of processes, like everyone gets a balloon in the audience. You think about some stress you're having. You blow that in the balloon, and then everyone at once lets go of that balloon.
Absolutely.
And if you can picture like 500 balloons floating around the audience and people laughing, it's quite wonderful.
Yes.
And A is attitude, you know. Really, we all have a choice. We talked about choice. Everything is a choice, no matter what it is in life. And our attitude of, you know, there's one book called The Course in Miracles. And there's one question they ask, it's about choice. Like if you get in an argument or upset, do you want to be right or do you want to be happy?
Right, right.
So it's always a choice. The U is Y-O-U.
Mm-hmm.
I cheated a little, Y-O-U, that you're the only one that can let go. You're the only one that can change your attitude. The G is go do it, and that's where I have 14 techniques in the Healing Power of Humor, like having a prop around, a photo around, cartoon around. And the H is open your humor eyes and ears and look and listen for humor. It is all around. I'll give you one example.
Yes.
I was in the laundromat and I looked on the wall and there was a sign. And the sign said, when the machine stops, remove all your clothing. Which I did.
Oh, no, you didn't.
So there is humor all around, but we need to look for it.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Can you give us some examples of how the quotations in your books have changed people's lives?
So I have, in addition to The Healing Power of Humor, my latest book, You Can't Ruin My Day, I have seven uplifting quotation books, motivational, inspirational quotation books.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many fabulous quotes in there. And I get letters of how it's changed people's lives. And one letter I got, it's kind of a sad letter, but it that quotation really helped this person. She said she was raped twice when she was a teenager.
Mm-mm.
And for 55 years, she never told anyone about it. 55 years, Sissy.
Wow.
And she said, I found this quote by Dale Carnegie about taking back your power.
Yes.
And how your anger, your upset is not hurting your abductors or the people that hurt you at all, because
mm-hmm.
they don't know how upset, but it's upsetting you for all those years. She said she took back her power because of that one quote, and she has finally, after 55 years, forgiven those people and gotten on with her life.
Isn't that something? That you're describing what I call trapped trauma. I have an education in counseling, and I have a viewpoint about trapped trauma and how unless it is released, Alan, it stays there and festers and can cause all kinds of depression and fear and all even physical illnesses. And so it's wonderful when that can be released by, like you said, it can be a quotation, it can be an encounter with someone who will listen. It can even be laughter. I mean, you know, there's so many ways that God gives us to release that feeling.
Right.
But that's a wonderful thing that she was finally able to release that and to forgive.
Right, finally. And it didn't, the interesting thing to me, it didn't take a lot. It took one powerful quotation, and I didn't even write that quotation.
Goodness.
I didn't even write those words,
yes.
But she
yes.
found it in my book.
Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that wonderful? Well, you have a remarkable story of how you found, is it Viva Editions, your current publisher? Please tell us how that happened.
Right. Well, I believe in affirmations, prayer, you know, positive thinking, positive words.
Yes.
So I had 7 quotation books published by Random House, a division of Random House.
Mm-hmm.
And Random House was cost-cutting and closed that division. And so there were 7 books, even though they sold over 400,000 copies, Random House was not going to publish them anymore. So I got the rights back. And I struggled for a year and a half trying to get a publisher and I could to republish them, and I could not find anyone that would do that. So I believe in not, you know, the universe telling me to stop struggling and just let God take over and see what
right.
happens.
Right.
So I put this sign on my desk, which I still have right here, that
mm-hmm.
says, "The perfect publisher will find me." And about 3 months later, I went to this meeting of writers and the publicists, and I heard these two women, I overheard them say, "We have a very successful publishing company, but we're opening a new division, and we are looking for positive, uplifting, motivational books." And I turned
there
to them
go.
And I said, I have 7 of them ready to go. And they gave me their card, and they say, "Okay, send us those books." And I looked at their card, and this was the first miracle. I looked at their card, and their office was 5 blocks from where I live.
No, it wasn't. Oh, my goodness.
Yes. So I brought them. I just hand-delivered the books the next day, and they considered publishing 1 or 2, which they started to do. And then they got 2... big for their little office, so they moved to a bigger office. They had this big party. I walk in. This woman comes right up to me. She said, "I own this company." She said, "I'm so glad you're with us. You don't know me, but I know you." Look at her and look at her and I go, "I don't know you. Why do I know, you know, how come you know me?" And she said, "For about 10 years, I lived across the street from you, and I'd see you walk your dog every single day."
How awesome.
The perfect publisher has found me.
Yes, yes. I believe, you know, I believe in that. I really do. I believe that if we are patient and prayerful about it, the right doors will open at the right time. Sometimes the doors are closed, and you know, I accept that. I've accepted that so many times in my own life that I feel the right doors open at the right time if we really, really have faith about
right.
that. Alan, what advice would you give to aspiring writers? There might be some writers in our listening audience who need some advice from you.
Very simple. Sit down and write.
That's good advice.
And the reason I say that, I used to belong to a writers group, and one of the members, for years that I was in the group, you know, we'd meet once a month, and she'd talk about wanting to write this book. And maybe she'd bring one or two pages of the book, and then not any the next month. And you cannot write a book if it's just in your head. So sit down and write. Even if you just do one page a day, by the end of the year, you will have that book written.
You sure will.
But you've got to sit down and do it.
Absolutely. Well, Alan, what's next on your publishing agenda? What are you working on?
Well, I have another contract. I'm writing another book right now that's called Secrets Kids Know and Adults Ought to Learn.
Oh.
Because I think kids are such wise creatures. And
yes, they are.
And could teach us so much. And often we, as adults, we kind of tell them, you know, settle down, get serious, or, you know,
yeah.
And we destroy some of that wonderful creative energy they have. And
yeah.
So I want to remind readers how great kids are and all that we can learn from them.
They are, absolutely. Kids are my favorite pastime on earth. I raised my own grandson since he was 4. He's
oh, wow.
20. He's 20 years old now. And just about through with college, and just a wonderful kid. So I had this emptiness in my heart, like this emptiness thing I'm going through, because he just filled up my heart. He's one of the most precious kids I've ever encountered in my life. So I prayed about it. Oh, I need something to fill this spot. And I volunteered to read to kids at a community center here in Memphis. And I'm telling you, that is the best hour of my whole week, because they're anywhere from 2 to 10 years old, and they are so innocent and transparent and so spontaneous and just so precious. And I think this is the last innocent, precious thing on earth, and we need to protect these children, because they're just brimming over with, like you say, creativity and happiness
and joy and passion
and truth.
Yeah, all of that.
You can find
yeah.
the truth in a child. They will tell you the truth.
Oh, exactly.
But, yeah. Well, Alan, how can people find and buy your books? And as a matter of fact, I'd like to mention on the air, because I'm from Memphis, Tennessee, and the listeners, some of our listeners are from Memphis, and Alan, you mentioned that you have spoken at St. Jude, which is a very, very wonderful children's research hospital, children's hospital here in Memphis. You're available for speaking, and your books, I know, are available. How can people get in touch with you to have you come to speak, to present a seminar or a program, and buy your books?
Well, just go online, www.alanklein.com. Now, that's, need to spell it right, AlanKlein.com. Or they can email me at humor, HUMOR, at alanklein.com. And by the way, I was just looking at my computer. I've spoken in Memphis, but I've also spoken in Tennessee 18 different times.
Wow. Well, you must be a wonderful, I know you're a wonderful speaker just from talking to you. I have so enjoyed this hour. We've come to the close of another wonderful program with an inspiring guest. Alan, you're such a pleasure to talk to. He has shared the life-changing, uplifting, healing effects of humor and laughter, and I've enjoyed every moment of this interview. Alan has truly found one of the most important keys to overcoming grief, despair, stress, and discouragement, and that key is learning how to laugh in most any situation. Laughter disarms the sting of grief, fear, the negativity, and the worry we all experience in our lives. It doesn't mean that we're dismissing the brevity or seriousness of some situations, as Alan shared before. It just means we've called into action those powerful emotional lifelines that God has placed in all our hearts and souls for those times when we need them most. A good cry as well as a good laugh makes for a healthy soul. Thank you so much, Alan, for sharing with us tonight. And be sure and join me again next week when I'll be talking with another inspiring guest who reflects God's gifts. Till then, may God keep you in his tender care. Good night, Alan, and good night, listeners. Thank you.
LifeQuest Christian Network.